Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode contains material that may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Iceland in the 70s and in the 80s was a pretty miserable place to live in. This was a very unpleasant society.
Over 50 years ago, in the heart of Reykjavik, Iceland, a crime was committed which seemed to undermine Iceland's reputation as one of the world's most peaceful countries. It was the kind of crime associated with big cities and foreign places.
But this was quite special because this was more like an execution.
A taxi driver, not known to have any enemies, was discovered in his car, fatally shot in the head. A single bullet casing would later prove a pivotal piece of evidence. Beyond the bullet casing, clues were scarce, and as time passed, each unanswered question only added to the crime's enigma. There appeared to be no motive in the taxi driver's murder.
And I remember as a kid, I was thinking, you know, how can somebody shoot somebody with a gun and choose this spot? This is a residential area with full of houses. You want to kill somebody, you want to shoot somebody in the head. And you have most likely come into the car at a different spot and you make him drive before you do it. Why on earth would you do it there? It's ridiculous.
You're listening to Nordic Crimes, an unsolved homicide. It's January 18th, 1968, in Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland. It's 7 a.m. and the weather is especially bleak. It's windy, raining, and the streets are flooded with ice and water. January has been a cold month. Johan, a furniture maker, leaves his house on Löanesvegur and climbs into his car. As part of his routine, he sets off to pick up his son, Magnus, a medical student, to drive him to the hospital. On this particular morning, however, as he heads towards his son's place via Lögalækur Street, Johan's attention is drawn to a taxi. The taxi is parked awkwardly on the side of the street. Its rear end is standing out from the curve, and because it isn't parked directly in front of any particular house, It seems unlikely that the driver is there to pick someone up. Also, the brake lights are on and the engine is running. Something just seems off. Upon arriving at his son's, Johan tells Magnus about the car, and the two of them decide to head back and check it out. They return at about 7:10 a.m., and Magnus walks over to the vehicle, a white Mercedes-Benz.
My name is Magnus Johansson, a doctor.
Upon arriving at his son's, Johan tells Magnus about the car, and the two of them decide to head back and check it out. They return at about 7:10 a.m., and Magnus walks over to the car, a white Mercedes-Benz.
I walk out of the car and knock on the window, but the driver doesn't respond, so I open the door on the passenger side and poke the man. But he doesn't move, so I reached over and grabbed his hand and felt that he was cold. He was obviously dead.
His father returns home, phones the police, and meanwhile, Magnus stays behind to keep watch. He actually goes back inside the car, and while doing this, he notices a hole in the back of the driver's head, which he identifies as a gunshot.
As my father had gone to call the police, I had sat inside the vehicle to snoop around a bit, because the whole thing struck me as utterly bizarre. I took my seat behind the driver and noticed a hole in the back of the man's skull and a clot of blood running downward. It was obvious that he had been shot in the head.
Shortly thereafter, the crime scene springs to life. There are uniformed police officers, plainclothes detectives, curious bystanders, and first responders. And when the police check the driver's ID, they learn that the man's name is Gunnar Sigurdur Tryggvason, employed by the Hreyfell taxi station. Born in 1925, Gunnar developed a lasting knee injury during his teens, which contributed, or so the story goes, to his obesity later in life. Being overweight was uncommon in Iceland at the time, and so it became one of Gunnar's defining features. He mostly kept to himself, and after winning a sizable sum in the lottery, he invested half the profits in a house that he bought with his parents, the other half he spent on a car, the white Mercedes-Benz that he employed as a taxi. Magnus informs the police officers of the hole in the back of the driver's head, but at first, they don't believe him.
One of them gave me a friendly pat on the shoulder and asked, "Have you read a lot of crime fiction?"
Despite their initial skepticism, the police go into the car and confirm Magnus's observations. And they also take note of an empty shell on the floor in front of the passenger side seat. They would later discover that the man's wallet was missing, so it seemed like he was the victim of a murder robbery. Magnus and his father gave a statement to the police.
And there was a policeman who took our statement, but he took both of our statements at the same time. Sometimes I would answer, and sometimes my father would. But the officer didn't make a distinction between the two of us, so it was very hard to determine who had said what. The superior officers who later read their report weren't particularly happy about this.
This casual mistake that Magnus describes, that of the first police officer not differentiating between him and his father, was actually one of many mistakes that the police would make over the course of their investigation. And if there's any through line in this case, it's these series of mistakes. The police seem to have bungled it right from the start. When news of the murder reached the public, it sent a shiver down the collective spine of the country. You can't forget that Iceland is a small nation, and in the 70s, Reykjavik was a city of maybe 70,000 people. On the following days, the police provided regular updates to the media and asked the public to phone in with tips. The first step in the investigation was establishing a timeline for Gunnar's last night as a taxi driver. The police managed to construct this timeline from about 1 a.m. to 4:40 a.m., which was when another taxi driver had spotted Gunnar parked near the crime scene in the Laugadalur neighborhood. Between 4:40 and 5:45 a.m., however, there was a gap. The police discovered that the last person who may have seen Gunnar alive was an engine tender, who had finished his shift at the city's fertilizer factory at about 5:30 a.m. His friends had dropped him off in the Laugadalur neighborhood, where he had exited the car and hurried homeward. On his way home, he spotted the white Mercedes-Benz parked awkwardly on the side of the street and recognized Gunnar, easily identifiable because he was overweight, by the light of the soft glow from inside the vehicle. But the engine tender also took note of another person, a dark figure leaning forward unsteadily in the passenger seat behind the driver. "Oh boy, Gunnar is driving some drunk around," the man thought to himself. And then he kept walking. The evidence at the crime scene was relatively scant. There were no footprints and no clues found in the surrounding area. There were, however, partial prints inside the car, and the police also discovered a glove tag, which may have suggested that the killer was wearing gloves. The car's ashtray contained several cigarette stubs, including one of a brand called John Silver. But these would later prove to be dead ends. When the officers had arrived on the scene, they noticed that the taxi meter was still running. They could have used the taxi meter to determine when Gunnar embarked on his final journey, but a crucial mistake was made. An officer who checked the meter at 7:50 a.m. recorded the amount as 87 krona. Another officer who checked the meter again at 8:23 a.m. recorded the same amount. The most significant piece of evidence found at the crime scene was the shell on the floor in front of the passenger side seat, a 35 caliber bullet casing, indicating that the murder weapon was a semi-automatic handgun that released empty shells to the right. The casing was labeled REM-UMC-35S&W, meaning that the bullet was intended for a 35 caliber Smith & Wesson handgun.
To tell you the truth, I am not really interested in crimes.
This is Sigursteinn Másson, Iceland's leading crime reporter, who's covered most of the big crime cases in Iceland's recent history. You can think of him as a kind of Virgil to our Dante in our trip through Iceland's criminal underworld. He did an episode on the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason for a TV program that he produced in the 90s.
I'm interested in the human aspect and the human behavior and responses to strange circumstances.
But what also interested Sigursteinn in this case was the nature of the crime, that it appeared to have been a murder robbery.
Which you would more like find in America, you know, something like this, where somebody would be shot in the head just from the back, just for his wallet, you know. But this was very un-Icelandic.
And what was also very un-Icelandic was that it seemed like the man had been executed.
We have not many murders in Iceland. On average, we have had about 4 murders per year in Iceland for a long time. But this was quite special because this was more like an execution.
And the unusualness of this crime, this execution-style murder robbery, inspired an editorial on the pages of the Morgunblaðið newspaper, which captured the Icelander's state of mind well. The murder was described as, quote, cold-blooded and heinous, and the author questioned if Iceland had now become like one of those big, crime-ridden cities in foreign countries. And even though Sigursteinn wasn't born when the murder took place, He recalls growing up in Reykjavik and thinking about the case.
This case, it touched me also more because my grandparents lived there at Laugalæk, very close to the scene. And as a child, I was also often thinking about it as a child when I came from them. And I always saw the house. There's this blue and white house, the big swimming pool there on the right-hand side. And I was often focusing my eyes on this spot where the Mercedes-Benz, the white Mercedes-Benz car of Gunnar Tryggvason was found. And I remember as a kid, I was thinking, you know, how can somebody shoot somebody with a gun and choose this spot where you have, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, you have all the people, they are going to go into the swimming pool, you know. You have a house next door, only like 8 meters, you know, or 10 meters from the crime scene. You have, I think, 4 apartments in that house. This is a residential area with full of houses. You want to kill somebody. You want to shoot somebody in the head. And you have most likely come into the car at a different spot and you make him drive before you do it. Why on earth would you do it there? It's ridiculous.
Now, most people must have assumed at the time that given the location of the murder combined with the smallness of Iceland, that the investigation would be wrapped up rather quickly, as most other murder cases in Iceland were. But this would not be the case. First and foremost, as noted by Dr. Magnús, the investigation seems to have been hampered by the inexperience of the police and their relatively few numbers. After that first officer bungled Magnús's initial interview, he was called in again to make a statement a few weeks later.
I was called again a bit later, probably a few weeks later. And this time there was this prosecutor who took my statement. At the time, I had gathered some information because I wanted to help out with the investigation. And I also admit that I probably found it a bit exciting. I had studied a bit of forensic medicine at the time, and so I was certain, in the light of the fact that inside of the car was still warm, and that when I felt the man's hand, he was ice cold, that some time must have passed from the time he was murdered until we came upon his body. So I began saying this during the interview, and the prosecutor retorted, "Did you measure the body's temperature yourself?" I stopped being helpful. It was pure arrogance.
Magnús also noted that it seemed to have taken some time before the police actually performed a proper search of the surrounding area.
This area was visible to me from my apartment. A week later, I saw 40 to 50 cops that were scouring the area from Laugalækur to what is now Laugalækur School. At the time, this was uncultivated tussocky ground. They were digging around in the snow, searching for the murder weapon or clues.
All of this may be more understandable if placed in the context of the difficult conditions at the crime scene. It was still dark when Magnús and his father had arrived, it was raining, windy, and the surrounding area was inundated with water and ice. But there's one mistake that the police made which served to greatly disturb the crime scene that's difficult to forgive. Despite Magnús, the medical student, estimating that Gunnar had been dead for an hour, the police officers, believing that they detected movement when they first entered the car, thought that he still might be alive. Gunnar was rushed to the ER by an ambulance, where he was immediately pronounced dead. And at that point in the investigation, many people had gone in and out of the car, Magnus, the officers, the EMTs, not to mention all the passengers from before Gunnar's death. Given the impossible conditions at the crime scene, the police decided to move the vehicle to their headquarters at 10 a.m. They took pictures and performed a preliminary examination of the car, but were forced to take a break at noon so as to allow the car to dry off. The official investigation didn't begin until 1 p.m., and it concluded 3 hours later. The vehicle was then handed over to Gunnar's family later that same day. It was never investigated further. The police followed several leads during the beginning of their investigation, one of which was inspired by the John Silver cigarette stub in the vehicle's ashtray, and another by the glove tag. But most of the evidence led the police down dead ends. In a desperate effort to bring the killer to justice, Gunnar's fellow drivers at the Hrevitz taxi station offered to anyone possessing information leading to an arrest a staggering 100,000 krona, a third of Gunnar's annual salary. Early on in their investigation, the detectives also began to entertain the idea that Gunnar's murder had been a premeditated act carried out by an enemy, and that the killer had simply taken the wallet as a means of misleading the investigation. There were rumors floating around at the time that Gunnar may have been operating a loan business on the side, rumors that may have started because of his considerable savings, but which may have also originated with the fact, as previously noted, that Gunnar had won the highest lottery prize awarded at the time in Iceland. But the problem with this theory was that Gunnar seemed to be very well liked by all those who knew him. Here's Sigursteinn Másson.
There were no informations to be found of any enemies or anybody who would have had a clear reason to kill him. And therefore, this also seemed, which was also interesting from Icelandic perspective, particularly random rather than a well-thought-through target.
As previously noted, the most important piece of evidence from the crime scene was the bullet shell, which the police eventually determined to have originated from a rare Smith & Wesson 35 caliber handgun, one of very few in existence in Iceland. So, in late January, a police officer by the name of Laurus Salomonsson, a former wrestler who was a good friend of Jóhannes Jósefsson, one of Iceland's most famous wrestlers, recalled that Jósefsson had told him a few years back that one of his guns had gone missing.
There you come to this Icelandic reality where everybody knows everybody, sort of.
Pursuing this lead, Laurus pays an informal visit to Jósefsson on February 14th and asks whether he still owns any bullets from the stolen gun. Jósefsson directs him to a hunting bag in his cellar, where Laurus discovers a dozen or so bullets. He can thereby prove that Josefsson's gun fired the same caliber bullets as the murder weapon. And it is, as far as he knows, the only such weapon in Iceland. Having informed his colleagues of this fact, Laurus visits Josefsson's home with another police officer on the following day, February 15th. They show Josefsson a few pictures of different types of guns, among them 32 and 35 caliber Smith & Wesson handguns, which are very similar in appearance. Josefsson immediately identifies the 35 caliber as the kind that went missing from his home in 1965. He had brought the gun home with him in 1927, he explains, and probably last fired it 10 years later. And at this point, it becomes extremely important to find the person who had taken the gun. But here, the police make yet another mistake. They don't immediately begin to investigate how the gun had gone missing. For if the gun had been taken during a burglary, That would have made locating the thief difficult. But had it been taken by someone close to Josefsson, that would have served to significantly narrow the list of possible suspects. Now, Gunnar's autopsy revealed that the bullet had entered his head just below the hairline on the right side, pointing to a right-handed shooter. The angle of the shot also suggested that the killer was of a short stature. Among those individuals who were interviewed in connection with the missing gun was Johannes's former personal driver, a man by the name of Sveinbjörn Gíslason, who also happens to be short and drives a taxi. When questioned, Sveinbjörn maintains that he knows nothing about the missing weapon, and the police rule him out as a suspect quite quickly. With no further leads regarding the gun, the investigation begins to peter out. Later that year, a taxi drivers' association pressures the police to seek the assistance of foreign experts, and at the end of November, another association requests a report on the state of the investigation. But the police have no updates.
The investigation in the beginning was not good, you know. And that is the case with so many crime cases I have looked into and done programs about. Because, you know, the weaknesses in most of the police investigation work, as I see it, is, first of all, not detailed enough investigation in the very beginning, you know, on the scene. And then not enough thorough investigation about the closest environment of the victim, you know, the very closest environment. In this case, I don't think there is any reason to believe that any of the close families of, you know, the family of Gunnar was involved in this. Absolutely not. But you do investigate that first very, very thoroughly, you know, because more than 70% of all murders are people who know the victim very well. You know, the one who commits it is a friend or family. But what happened here and what happens in so many cases is that the police comes up with some theory, like in this case, robbery. And then it goes on with that theory and takes it on. And then all the investigation is about proving that theory, even if they see on the way it can't work, you know. It doesn't add up.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A A year has passed since the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason, and the case appears to be going cold. But then, a coincidence. A gun is discovered in the glove compartment of a repossessed taxi formerly driven by Sveinbjörn Gíslason. That's Jósefsson's former personal driver, the one who was interviewed by the police early on in the investigation, but quickly ruled out.
And then suddenly it appears, you know, a year later, 1969, in a taxi car that did not belong to Sveinbjörn, but Sveinbjörn was renting, basically, from other taxi drivers.
When he realizes that the gun has been found, Sveinbjörn arrives home, picks up the phone, and calls his friend, police officer Laurus Salomonsson. And something about Sveinbjörn's tone must have suggested urgency, for Laurus pays him a visit at once. Sveinbjörn, whom Laurus knew to have been employed by Jóhannes Jósefsson at Hotel Borg, tells Laurus that he has gotten himself into trouble on account of his own stupidity. Someone had left a gun beneath the passenger side seat of his car in January, and he had decided to lock the gun away in the glove compartment, hoping that he'd be able to ascertain the identity of the owner when that person showed up and claimed it. But no one ever did. Later that day, the police decide to instruct Laurus to arrest Sveinbjörn Gíslason. So Laurus pays another visit to Sveinbjörn's house at 6:30 p.m. and announces that he's bringing him in. Sveinbjörn asks if he's going to be locked up. Laurus says he doesn't know. And so they drive to the Department of Criminal Investigations with three other police cars in tow, and Laurus and Sveinbjörn engage in a conversation during the ride, which seems rather incriminating. "Do I have any way of defending myself?" Sveinbjörn asks. "The best argument is the truth," Laurus replies, to which Sveinbjörn is to have responded, "Oh, God, help me." What exactly Sveinbjörn meant by those words is hard to determine, as Laurus failed to immediately press him on the issue. The discovery of the gun sparks new life into the investigation, and Sveinbjörn's alibi on the night of the murder is shaky. After Sveinbjörn's arrest, the police actually find a bullet in Sveinbjörn's safe that bears the same engravings as the bullet lodged in Gunnar's head. Given these incriminating facts, Sveinbjörn, who's kept in custody for most of the year, changes his story. He eventually cops to stealing the gun from Jósefsson, but always maintains his innocence as far as the murder is concerned, and actually tries to implicate someone else.
Sveinbjörn admitted that he took the gun from Jóhannes. He could not refuse that. But then he said that soon after that happened, the gun disappeared.
Nevertheless, the police are faced with two problems. One, the evidence isn't strong enough. None of it links him directly to the crime. And two, there appears to be very little motive. On September 22, 1969, the Office of the Public Prosecutor pursued criminal charges against Sveinbjörn. He was charged on two counts: the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason, on the one hand, and the stealing of the gun from the home of Jóhannes Jósefsson, on the other. But the first count came with an added clause. Quote, "The defendant is accused of having, in the early hours of Thursday, January 18, 1968, killed taxi driver Gunnar Sigurður Tryggvason, or having, in any other way, aided in the execution of the crime." The second clause was problematic because it suggested that someone else had killed Gunnar, whom the police had not succeeded in identifying. The trial began on January 19, 1970. Sveinbjörn's defense attorney argued that his client had always maintained his innocence and pointed to the numerous flaws in the investigation. There were no fingerprints. The glove tag that was found in the car was from a brand of gloves that Sveinbjörn had never owned, and furthermore, Sveinbjörn had not behaved any differently after the murder. Also, he argued, the police had failed to establish a motive. The money stolen was too meager an amount to inspire murder. Finally, the defense attorney concluded that the charges brought against Sveinbjörn were unprecedented in the legal history of Iceland, for the case rested entirely on probability. There was no evidence linking Svempia to the murder, and the gun proved nothing. In the end, Sveinbjörn was only charged on the second count, that of having stolen the gun, but that charge was dropped on a technicality. Sveinbjörn was found guilty of a possession of a firearm without a license, but as he had already been in custody for 11 months, the fine was dropped. Sveinbjörn was then again acquitted during an appeal to the Supreme Court. At the time, most people seemed to have believed that Sveinbjörn had committed the murder, although some, like Dr. Magnus, may have never really bought into this idea.
Leaving the murder weapon in the glove compartment of his taxi. It was too stupid to be true. That's what I always thought. It can't be that someone can be so dumb, not getting rid of the gun. Some may want to keep such a weapon as a kind of memento.
In 1999, 30 years after Sveinbjörn Gíslason was acquitted, journalist Sigursteinn Másson, who we met earlier on, produced a television program called True Icelandic Crimes. For an episode on the 1968 murder of Gunnar Tryggvason, Sigursteinn actually sat down with Sveinbjörn Gíslason and his wife.
When I met then Sveinbjörn later, after I had persuaded his wife, you know, I thought at that time and that moment that I was interviewing a killer. And I felt that his wife did not really know what to think.
There was, however, something that always bothered Sigursteinn about the case.
The lack of motive for Sveinbjörn to do this was always quite striking, you know. It was never really believable. It was out of character, you know, from him. And another thing which is very important to keep in mind, that he was, for a very long time, in custody under very hard circumstances in the old prison in Skólavörðustígur. It seems to me that he really did not know what happened to Gunnar Tryggvason. And I believe that today.
Ten years after Sigursteinn's first season of True Icelandic Crimes premiered, the news program Fréttaaukin aired an episode on the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason. After the episode aired, a viewer contacted reporter Elin Hurst, claiming that she possessed new information about the case. She agreed to be interviewed for television on the condition of anonymity. Her brother made no such demands.
Yeah, my name is Valgeir. Skagfjörð. I'm an actor and musician.
Valgeir's interview with Fréttaaukin was aired shortly after his sister had stepped forward. The story that Valgeir and his sister told was this. In early 1969, a year after Gunnar's murder, the siblings had been home alone on a Sunday morning, as their mother had gone out for drinks on the previous evening, but never returned home.
My mother, she was an alcoholic, and she was mentally disturbed. She had personality disorders and she was not very capable as a mother. And sometimes she took off and she wasn't at home for days. So this Sunday morning...
The three of them were residing at the top floor of an apartment building in Reykjavik. Valgeir and his sister were eating toast when the doorbell rang three times to indicate that it was safe to open at about 10 a.m.,
There was a kind of a sign on the bell, because we lived on the fifth floor in a condo, and you were supposed to ring three times, and that would be the sign to open the door.
Believing that their mother had arrived at last, they pressed the buzzer and stepped out into the stairwell.
And then this guy suddenly appears, and he was very nervous. He was tied up. He was shaking a bit. And he went straight into our apartment and started asking questions about our mother, where she was. And
The man's speech was slurred and his behavior was erratic, and given Valkyr's rough childhood, he had grown rather adept at determining what substances an individual was abusing based on their behavior.
He was mumbling, you know, he was drunk and probably on some speed or something. Cocaine was not in Iceland yet at that time. So, and he was tense, violent, dangerous.
The man scoured the apartment momentarily, but then things took a frightening turn.
He took his gun, a gun out of his pocket, and he was pointing the gun at me and my sister and asking me if I had seen a gun before. And
Valkyr, who was of the generation that grew up watching cowboy films and who was quite familiar with famous firearms, did not recognize the gun. It was not a Luger nor a Magnum, and it was loaded with a magazine. Valkyr was terrified.
I became quiet, I became numb, and I couldn't say anything. And he was just waving this gun all around the apartment, and then he left, you know, and that's it. But the strange thing is that he knew the code, you know, the Morse code on the bell. So that indicates that he must have had some interaction with my mother.
At the time of the incident, Valkyr had informed a connection between the gun that the intruder had carried and the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason. It wasn't until later that an article ran in the paper stating that a handgun had been found in the glove compartment of Sveinbjörn's taxi. Viewing a picture of the gun, Valkyr recognized it as the same gun that the man had brandished upon barging into the apartment.
Yeah, it was the same kind of a gun, you know. And and my mother, she started, you know, she was, she knew this guy who had been arrested.
Same kind of gun, different guy. Of this, Valkyr is certain. He knew Sveinbjörn well. He was a friend of the family who would often assist Valkyr's mother in times of need. And she was so convinced of his innocence that she actually tried to concoct an alibi for Sveinbjörn.
She wanted to assist him in a way to prove his innocence by making a statement about something, you know, but she was drunk and her statement was considered unreliable. And she interfered in the investigation and you know, she stirred it up a little bit, but then they realized that this woman was not to be taken seriously, so...
And you never believed that, given that you knew him and everything that you knew about him, that...
No, it was very hard to believe that he would be able to kill anybody. You know, it was a nice guy. He was good to us, me and my sister, and... Yeah, it was hard to believe, yeah. But also my mother, she was very convinced about his innocence.
Valkyr's mother lived a dissolute life, and Valkyr would later characterize his childhood as something of a carousel of drunk people, swinging in and out of whatever apartment in which they were currently staying. Among those who frequented their apartment in the late 60s were taxi drivers, police officers, and the criminal element.
She was usually drunk or under some kind of a influence of drugs, medicine, and things like that. So she was very unreliable. And you never, you couldn't believe anything she said. And then there were different guys who came for partying or for a cup of coffee. And sometimes they, sometimes there were some different men in her bed also, you know. And sometimes they left money on the table. And my sister would like come, hey, well, is mommy a whore, you know? And, you know, it's, yeah. So those men coming in and out of our home was just a normal thing when I was growing up, you know.
I can imagine that must have been quite difficult.
Yeah. But, you know, it's been, it's taken some years of self-work to clean the shit out of my system. But, yeah.
And what happened to your mother?
She died when she was 60. Yeah, she was drunk and she fell on the floor and hit her head on a corner of a table. And that's it.
Given the company that Valkyr's mother was keeping, it was not unlikely that she had heard something about the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason. Valkyr actually recalls hearing several conspiracy theories about the crime when he was younger, and his mother always claimed to have known the true identity of the killer. But there was another thing about the sibling's encounter with his mysterious intruder. Valkyr's sister actually claimed that the man had introduced himself, and that he had told the siblings that he was a killer, that he had used the gun, the one he was holding, to kill Gunnar Tryggvason. The name he used, according to Valkyr's sister, was Thráinn. On March 31st, 1979, 10 years after the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason, a 36-year-old man by the name of Thráinn joined his friend Margrét for drinks at Hotel Borg. At around 2 a.m., the two of them went to Thráinn's apartment to continue drinking, where they were eventually joined by Thráinn's neighbors, Svavar and Lóa. The couple lived on the same floor as Thráinn, and they'd also returned home from a night out on the town. The two apartments shared a bathroom, and it was there that evening that Thráinn and Lóa crossed paths, a chance encounter that inspired a fit of jealousy in Loa's husband, who accused her of having an affair. The argument eventually died down, and when Svavar and Lóa retired to bed, Thráinn and Margrét continued to drink. In the morning, Thráinn bumped into Svavar outside the bathroom, and the latter inquired if Thráinn had anything to drink. He then fetched a bottle of vermouth from his apartment, and the two men plopped down in his living room to drink. They were later joined by Lóa, and after they had finished their first bottle, Thráinn fetched another, before leaving on a cigarette run to a nearby pool hall. When Thráinn joined them inside the apartment later that day, Svavar again accused Lóa of having an affair. There was a large kitchen knife lying on the living room table, which Svavar grabbed and, in a fit of jealous rage, directed towards the woman and thundered, "Do you want to kill me?" Lóa replied that she was incapable of such a thing, which was when Svavar walked into the kitchen and began to confront Thráinn. "What about you, you puppy? Do you have the courage?" Thráinn would later testify that Svavar's look had been especially threatening, and that he could only recall standing before his neighbor and holding the knife. What had happened during his blackout was that he had stabbed Svavar in his abdomen and essentially gutted him. And when Svavar fell forward, he said to Thráinn, "It's over. Finish it." Which was when Thráinn knelt down next to him and slit his throat. He then returned to his apartment and confessed to Lóa and Margrét. A transcript from the police interrogation states that Thráinn had remained calm and collected throughout. Thráinn claimed that he barely knew Svavar and had nothing against him. A report written by a forensic psychologist notes that although Thráinn was not suffering from a mental illness, he did have a personality disorder brought on by neurosis and anxiety, which could be traced to a tough childhood, and that he later tried to treat with alcohol. Thráinn struggled in school and later developed an inferiority complex. The report continues. Thráinn's reactions on April 1st become somewhat understandable if placed within the context of his inferiority complex, how far he'll go to prove his worth and courage. His judgment was also clouded by sleeplessness and heavy drinking. Thráinn was convicted and sentenced to 16 years in prison. It was by coincidence that reporter Sigurdur Másson stumbled upon an article about the murder on Hverfisgata sometime after the interview with Valkyr Skagfjörð was aired in 2009. Reviewing the facts of the case, Sigurdur was overtaken by an eerie feeling. There was something about the circumstances of the crime that recalled the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason. Not to mention the fact that Valkyr's sister had maintained that the man who barged into their apartment in 1969 had introduced himself with the name of Thráinn.
this murder of Gunnar Tryggvason was a pure execution, and the other murder where he stabs a neighbor, seemingly without any real reason, but he very brutally kills him and very cold-blooded. And that, I think, is the key thing in this. You know, it's like a brutal, cold-blooded murder with Gunnar, and the same that happens a decade later. And that is also quite rare in our criminal history. You know, like I say, I mean, you have murders under some dubious circumstances, you know, where there has been a lot of emotions and, you know, love affairs or what you have, you know, but this is so totally different.
Furthermore, Thráinn's age and appearance seem to fit the sibling's description, not to mention the implications of the psychological report.
Because, you know, there are certain things in this which are irrational. So there has to be an irrational person behind it. This is not something that is well thought through or planned.
And so, on Friday, January 17th, 2020, having received some pointers from the police, Sjöstedt visited Valkyr and his sister to conduct an informal photo lineup. He showed them pictures of six men, hoping to ascertain whether they could identify the person who had barged into their apartment in 1969. It was the first time in his career that he had conducted such a lineup.
This was, of course, you know, a controversial thing to do because, you know, I'm not a police officer and I have no authority to conduct such a lineup. But from my perspective, it was the only way to understand if there was a likelihood that in this unsolved case, because Sveinbjörn was acquitted, we could still, after all those years, find a possible suspect.
Before he began, Sjöstedt reminded the siblings that 51 years had passed since the incident and that all of the men in the pictures were dead. Valkyr was the first to examine the photos. Perusing them a while, Valkyr concluded that he was unsure, although two of the men looked familiar, especially subject number three. There was something about the man's eyes and his face. Sjöstedt also showed him a picture of the murder weapon, which Valkyr immediately recognized. And then it was his sister's turn. She identified suspect number three as a person who looked familiar, but also pointed to suspect number six. Asked to choose between the two men, she identified person number six, excusing her indecision with the fact that 50 years had passed since the incident. She did, however, agree with Valkyr as far as the gun was concerned. It was definitely the one the man had brandished inside their apartment. Sjöstedt went on to explain that the name of suspect number three was Thráinn, and that he had murdered a man in 1979 in a rather brutal fashion. He told them that he believed that there was a possibility that this person had also committed the murder of Gunnar Tryggvason. We asked Valkyr what he had made of this photo lineup and whether it was possible that the person he had identified had barged into their apartment when he was younger, the same person who was later sentenced to 16 years for the murder on Kvaðskata.
It's possible, but, you know, at least I think I know deep inside that this guy, he was the one who came to our home. I'm pretty sure of that. But if he killed the taxi driver, I don't know.
All of this is, of course, a matter of speculation. For Sjöstedt's investigation of the case has not revealed any direct connection between Sveinbjörn and Thráinn.
I haven't seen anything pointing to Thráinn knowing by himself or having any connections with Sveinbjörn so that he could get the gun from Sveinbjörn, because that was certainly the gun, that was the murder weapon. But there can be connections between people around Sveinbjörn who possibly had access to the car. I'm not saying that they are complicit or that per person could be or would be complicit to murder, but would possibly have handed the gun to Thráinn, which would have then given the gun at some point back without that person who was helping Thráinn with that ever having, you know, the intention to involve sempyutninet.
After Sjöstedt reported the results of his lineup to the police, a senior police officer announced to the media that the police had decided that it was necessary to start a preliminary investigation again. We reached out to the police regarding the current state of the investigation, but there has been no progress. The case remains unsolved.
Well, I think we are quite much closer, but there is still this loose end. Was there a connection between Thrawin and Sveinbjörn? That, I think, is the loose end. And that is, of course, something that I would like the police to find out.
This episode was written and reported by Ragnar Thomas. Producer and sound designer was Eirikur Sigurdsson. Executive producer is Nils Bergman. Nordic Crimes is a Tall Tale production. Please rate, review, and recommend the show to friends. Your support helps us reach listeners who might also appreciate the content. Thank you in advance.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.